Good morning, everybody. You can be opening your Old Testaments to the book of Proverbs. We'll be spending the vast majority of our time in this book. Specifically, Proverbs chapter 8. Ever since Satan's first conversation with Adam and Eve, especially with Eve at first, what Satan has tried to do is attempt to expand the options that humans think that we have in terms of how we live our lives, how we think, what we believe about reality. You know, the argument of the Bible is that God has unimaginable blessings to bestow on the people who surrender their thoughts and their lives to him and to his son. But Satan has been working very hard since the beginning to make it clear that God doesn't know what's best for you. Only you know that by looking deep inside yourself, your own heart, what you think works best for you. And that is very much the air that we breathe in the modern culture that we live. However many thousands of years have passed since that first conversation in the garden, that just continues to be the case. Even in our Western culture, very much removed from the ancient people of the past, I find it interesting that when studies are done, like this one done by Legionnaire Ministries and Lifeway Research, what they do is every 2 years they go to people who claim to be Christians and they ask them a series of questions that compare the current answers and the current thoughts to what people are thinking in years past. They do this about every 2 years. And so with this question of or the statement, rather, that God accepts the worship of all religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, you'll notice on the left-hand side of the screen, we have those who disagree with this. On the right-hand side, we have those who agree with it. And that number has fluctuated a little bit over the years, depending on which one you look at. But in the most recent study in 2022, you have about 56% of people who were asked this who agreed with that statement. In this one, that religious belief is a matter of personal opinion. It is not about objective truth. It is not about something outside of you, external to you and your thoughts and your life that you need to conform to. Most people, or at least compared to the past, 38% compared to 23 and 32 in years past would agree that that is the case. This is obviously concerning because what this shows is people who are drinking deeply of the opinions of people who are on the media, who are in the newspapers, who are writing books that many people consume. This woman is not unknown to any of us in this room, I would imagine. Oprah Winfrey has been on television for a very long time and continues to be so. And she said this in a YouTube video that you can look up. She said, one of the mistakes humans make is believing that there's only one way to live and that we don't accept that there are diverse ways of being in the world. There are many paths to what you would call God. And she's in the middle of a room of ladies and looking at one lady who is disagreeing with her when this video takes place. Her path might be something else. And when she gets there, she might call it the light. But her loving, her kindness, and her generosity, if it brings her to the same point it brings you, it doesn't matter whether she calls it God or not. Again, a rejection of objective truth. And this goes back to philosophers of the not-too-distant past who regularly preached this. This guy, by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, was a Swiss philosopher who worked in France for the majority of his life. And he said, in the very year that our Declaration of Independence was being written down in the United States of America, in which we are declaring that we have undeniable truths of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, he was saying in Europe, in his last book, I consecrate my latter days to the study of myself. and to the preparation of that account, which I must shortly render up of my actions, and I don't think he's talking about the day of judgment there, I resign my thoughts entirely to the pleasure of conversing with my own soul. I shall forget my misfortunes, disgraces, persecutors on recollecting and contemplating the integrity of my own heart. This guy was one of the founding fathers in the modern times of looking inside your heart to discover what is true for you. You know, the Bible encourages self-examination on a regular basis, but only as a way of further aligning yourself to God's revealed will, not something that just arbitrarily works for you. And what's interesting is when you look at some of the most recent things coming out in popular culture, some people are catching on to how sick this really is, this thought pattern of, I can just do whatever feels good to me. Here's a book that I have actually not read, so I cannot recommend it. But it's a book from 2013 called The Goldfinch. Somebody made a movie. I think Netflix made a movie out of it. It sold a whole bunch of copies. You might be able to see as you look at the book. It's a number one bestseller. Stephen King thought it was amazing. It's won a Pulitzer Prize. And the lady who wrote it, Donna Tartt, has one of her characters saying this. And this is a little bit of a longer quote, but it's important, so I want to read it with you. From William Blake to Lady Gaga, from Rousseau, who we just thought about, to Rumi, to Tosca, to Mr. Rogers, it's a curiously uniform message, accepted from high to low. When in doubt, what to do? How do we know what's right for us? Every shrink, every career counselor, every Disney princess knows the answer. Be yourself. Follow your heart. Only here's what I really, really want someone to explain to me. What if one happens to be possessed of a heart that can't be trusted? What if the heart, for its own unfathomable reasons, leads one willfully and in a cloud of unspeakable radiance away from health, domesticity, civic responsibility, and strong social connections, and all the blandly held common virtues, and instead straight towards a beautiful flare of ruin, self-immolation, disaster? Is Kitsy right, one of the main characters? If your deepest self is singing and coaxing you straight toward the bonfire, is it better to turn away? I think if Jesus were in a conversation with Donna Tartt, he might say, you are not far from the kingdom of heaven. Because this is exactly the sort of sick toxicity that our culture preaches, that many in the world, if they have a thinking mind and somewhat of a soft heart, look at and say, that doesn't work. I need something more substantial than my own thought processes and feelings. So there is confusion in our culture, but there is clarity in the scriptures. Especially when you go to the book of Proverbs, which is all about the wisdom of God. It's interesting, when you look at Proverbs 8, I have you turn to that chapter. I want you to read with me what wisdom says. As she preaches this point, that we need to look for wisdom in the one who has woven it into the fabric of the universe that we live in. Proverbs 8, wisdom herself is speaking, and we won't look at everything that she says here, but look at verse 22, beginning. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limits so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him. Like a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the children of man. Do you see the point being made by wisdom here? She is not just this abstract concept that you can just think about in your brain. She is making the argument that she was in everything as God was making the world. That she was put into the universe, rather like how God says that he dwells in unapproachable light. And here, what do we have on day one of creation? He took what he was in, what he had, and he put it in our realm to some sort of extent. He did that with wisdom. Wisdom is a character attribute of our God. And wisdom has been put in our universe in such a way that when we conform to it, we are blessed. And when we try to go against it, we rip ourselves into shreds. Now, I could take this sweater, and I could take it off, and I could put it down, and I could try to treat it like a pair of pants. And I could try to put both of my legs into these places that it might look like they could go, possibly, but in the process of doing that, I'm going to destroy this sweater because I'm trying to treat it in a way in which it was not created to be worn. And so this gives us a framework for understanding why it is that we need to follow everything that the Proverbs talk about the way that we should use money, the way that we should control and channel our sexual desires in a God-oriented way, the way that we talk to our neighbors and our friends, the way that we do everything that we do in our lives centers around this idea of there is a right way to go, not just many paths that are right. So God is very clear about what we should pursue and what we should not. We do not look within ourselves to determine the source of truth. And so if we were answering Donna Tartt's question in The Goldfinch about whether our hearts can be trusted, the answer is resounding from the scriptures in a multiplicity of places. I mean, you might be familiar with Jeremiah 17, where in an age where Israel, where Judah is following their own heart in all kinds of ways, Jeremiah, one of the last of Judah's prophets, gets up and says in 17 verse 9, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" So if you try to act like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and spend your day sitting in your chair thinking about yourself, trying to determine truth from your own inward thoughts, you're going to get lost in a labyrinth of conflicting emotions and thinking. Trust in the Lord, chapter 3, verse 5, a proverb says, trust in the Lord, not yourself, with all of your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. So the two paths are clear in Proverbs, and what I'd like to do for the remaining part of this lesson is go to chapter 9 and look at 1 through 18 with you about these two paths and the way that they are portrayed for us. So if you're familiar with the book of Proverbs, then you know that the first 9 chapters of the book are different from the rest of the book. From chapters 10 on through the end are a series of short statements, short proverbs, that teach us about what wisdom looks like and what it doesn't. But the first 9 chapters of Proverbs are very different. They are a series of discourses, of moments where Solomon, the writer of most of the book, is addressing himself to his sons, and he's trying to teach them the wisdom that he has gained from the Lord. And he does it in a series of very long speeches. And some of those speeches are from Lady Wisdom herself, and some of them are not. They're just from him talking to them. But I think it's no accident that wisdom and folly, the opposite of wisdom, are both portrayed as ladies in the book of Proverbs, because this book is addressed to men, young men, who, as they are growing up, that is often their focus, to be attracted to young ladies. And so he portrays them in this way to say, here's the one that you should run after, and here's the one that you should shun. So let's read this part of the book together. This is the last of the discourses before you get to the Proverbs of Solomon that begin in chapter 10, verse 1. And I want you to notice how wisdom and folly are contrasted with each other. Wisdom has built her house, chapter 9, verse 1. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has called out her young women to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come eat my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse. He who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man and he will increase in learning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. For by me your days will be multiplied and years will be added to your life. If you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. Verse 13, the woman folly is loud. She is seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat on the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way, whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. As we read through this passage, you probably noticed some similarities between these two women. For one thing, these women make their appeal to the simple. You see that in verse 4 and in verse 16. And whenever you read the word simple in Proverbs, it does not necessarily mean someone who is stupid, who is incapable of learning, who has a low IQ. It's more talking about the idea of naivete, someone who just is not aware of the knowledge and the wisdom that they could have if they sought the right source and not the wrong one. You notice that both of these women offer an invitation to sit down and eat with them, verse 5 and again verse 16, there it is. And both make their invitations with an urgent tone of voice, a listen to me, you got to hear what I have to say, you got to sit down at my table kind of attitude. You see that in verse 3 and in verse 14. But despite the similarities, obviously there is a world of differences between these two women. And since the New Testament, since the covenant that we are under in Jesus Christ so often counsels us as Christians to be wise as serpents, innocent as doves, to have the heart of wisdom, we got to look back at these proverbs and glean from them to understand what it is that we should look like in our thought life and in our behaviors. We have to choose Lady Wisdom because she comes from Jesus, and she leads us to Jesus. And that's how we'll end this lesson as we think about all these things. But I want you to notice the contrasts here, especially verse 11 and verse 18. Wisdom, Lady Wisdom, is open. She wants to tell you everything about who she is and what she has to offer. And folly looks like she does, but she wants to actually conceal who she is. It's interesting that 12 of these 18 verses are devoted to wisdom. And so from verses 4 through 12, wisdom is talking about all the different reasons why somebody might choose her. She's open about what is on her table, and she's open about where the path leads if you choose her, if you sit down at her table, where that's going to take you. And she tells us that the way somebody reacts to her invitation says a lot about who that person is. The righteous and the wise are teachable people. It's kind of like what we talked about this morning during the reign of Hezekiah. He sent messengers up north to people who had been worshiping idols in darkness for generations. not been interested in the Lord. And many of them mocked when they got the invitation in the mail for the Passover. But it says, and I love that in Chronicles, where the text says that some men of some of these northern tribes humbled themselves. It took admitting that you were wrong in doing what you did up north in order to come down to Jerusalem for maybe the first time in your life and worship at a temple that you had spurned, you and your fathers. Wisdom is teachable. Those who have wisdom, those who want wisdom, are willing to humble themselves to get what they need from the Lord. Notice how Lady Wisdom talks about how to develop wisdom. The fear of the Lord is how that comes. And the greater my understanding of God, the greater my insight will be. Verse 12, she emphasizes personal responsibility. Ultimately, it is everyone's individual choice about whether we are wise or not. We can talk about the influences of our culture. We might be able to talk about the poor family structure that we might have had growing up, or the neighbors that played next to us as kids, or the schools that we went to that were not good, or all the different negative influences that we could point to. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is your choice and it is my choice about whether we are wise or not. And I can point to so many Christians that I know, some of whom I'm currently working and worshiping with at Teensboro, who came out of terrible backgrounds. Backgrounds that I cannot explain publicly. But they chose Lady Wisdom. And they are now servants of the Lord and opening up their lives to other people and giving of what has been given to them. This is a beautiful picture. But what does Lady Folly do? You know, she wants to tell you about the yummy things that are on her table as well. And she's even open about where that meal comes from. When she says stolen bread and stolen water is nice to consume, I think she's implying that what she has spread out on her banquet table, which is very different from the look of the banquet table of Lady Wisdom, what she has to offer, she didn't produce. She stole it. And she has that to offer to those who are interested. But look again at verse 18. Is Lady Folly open about the consequences of her meal? Do you see the last part of this chapter that are there, and that her guests are in the depths of Sheol? Because she neglected to mention that little detail to him that would have been good to understand, unlike Wisdom. Another contrast that you see here in the text is that Wisdom creates, but Folly destroys. Go back to the beginning part of the chapter and notice what is said about Wisdom. You notice the first thing is said is that she is a hard worker. She has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. She has set her table. She has sent out her young women to call from the highest places of the town. And she has a lot to offer because she has personally invested herself in making this wonderful place for someone to enjoy. Seven pillars, not just two or three or four. This is a picture of stability and completeness. And she's got meat on the table that she has ensured is coming in, that she has slaughtered, or she has made sure somebody slaughtered, and she has people being sent out. This is a beautiful picture. There's nothing lacking here. There is wealth and riches and honor and power here. But what about Folly? What is she doing? She's got a table too. She doesn't have meat on that table. She's got bread. She's got water. But in contrast to Lady Wisdom, who's been bustling around town doing all kinds of things, Lady Folly just seems to be sitting around, not really doing much at all. You notice that Wisdom has messengers, helper ladies that she's sending out, but you notice there's an absence in the text about that for Lady Folly. She doesn't have other people helping her. She has prepared a table, but again, the food and the drink were stolen from somebody else's labors. She hasn't built anything. She has nothing useful to offer anyone else. All she can do is pervert. She cannot serve. She cannot give. She takes and she tears down. And when you think about the one that we are fighting, that's really all Satan can do. He has so-called blessings to offer, but they are blessings that he has stolen from the ways of God and twisted into something horrible that he gives a veneer of safety and completeness over. I love this quote from the Screwtape Letters. Maybe some of you read C.S. Lewis. There's a part where this one demon is saying to another demon, "All pleasures are God's invention, not ours. He made the pleasures. All of our research so far has not enabled us to produce one." That's all Satan has to offer. So we need to be asking ourselves this question: are we spiritual wrecking balls or are we spiritual builders? Are we primarily relying on the other Christians around us to open up this book and to mine it and to prepare a banquet feast? Or are we the ones who are doing this ourselves? Are we just sitting around trying to suck the life out of other people? Or are we those Christians who can be counted on to immerse ourselves in the Word so that when somebody around us needs a word of encouragement or a rebuke or something from God's Word, we are prepared to have something to offer? We know where to turn to in this book to give that. Or do we more closely resemble Lady Folly, who doesn't do any work herself? She just steals from the work of other people. We want to be those industrious spiritual workers that God can count on to get stuff done. Wisdom has insight, you'll notice, but Lady Folly knows nothing. You know, wisdom understands the ways of God, and she pours out that instruction in this text. You notice she says, "I can help you to walk in the way of insight," and then she gives a preview of what she has to offer. There's this miniature discourse in the middle of her invitation. She says, "Come sit down at my table," and then she starts to explain, "Here's what wisdom is, and here's why it's valuable, and here's how you can have it." And you notice how what she says really imitates the very beginning of the book of Proverbs. As Proverbs opens chapter 1, I think it's in verse 7, Solomon says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." In verse 10 of chapter 9, you'll notice that Lady Wisdom doesn't say that verbatim, but she says something extremely close to it. But what does Folly have to say? All she says is verse 17. "Stolen water sweet, bread eaten in secret is pleasant." But she's loud about that. But although she's loud, she's making up for the fact that she has nothing actually to say. Her message is a hollow shell of the life that we could all have if we sought God. And if you read the writings of humanistic philosophers, if you listen to people in the media, they are loud, but they have nothing of substance to say because they do not have wisdom. You know, all of us have complex issues that we have to work through in our lives. And if we don't have wisdom, then all kinds of things might occur to us as legitimate and valuable, but are actually not. At my time of life, my wife's time of life, the question of how do we best raise our children in this world is one of the first and foremost questions on our minds. And there are all kinds of answers to that question if you read or you listen to many in the world. Even Abraham Lincoln had opinions about that. He said, "It is my pleasure that my children are free, happy, and unrestrained by parental tyranny." And there might be some ideas in there that sound good on the surface. And obviously, all of us should be against parental tyranny. But does a child's happiness truly come with being completely unrestrained, as Abraham Lincoln's children often were? Or does that happiness come through loving submission to parental authority? Proverbs has lots to say about that. You know, you read in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 15, "Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him." You know, for a long time, I took it for granted that Christians believed passages like that. Until one day in my first work in Arkansas, I was taking a ride in the truck of another young man. Neither one of us had had any children at that point. We were both married. And the subject of how to raise children came up in the course of the conversation. And my jaw about hit the truck floor when he started to explain to me the different philosophers in child training that he had been listening to recently and how they were affecting his views on how to parent and how he believed at that point that we had progressed past the ideas of the book of Proverbs and what it teaches us about folly in children and about how to drive that from them in passages like the one that was just read. And then I came to realize that we can't take that for granted in each other anymore. Does wisdom go out of date? Does human nature change with the passage of time? We need to realize that the Word of God will always be timeless and relevant and powerful to change our hearts and our lives. And we need to be so careful about the things that we listen to that come from man. I have a plaque up in my office on my wall that I have to look at on a regular basis to remind me of the fact that we need to be careful of the books that we read, the voices that we listen to, because books have the power to change our lives. If the counselors you seek, if the books you read or the podcasts that you listen to conflict in some way with the wisdom that God has already revealed, then you know automatically which one is folly and which one is wisdom. The last contrast we'll look at. All right, here we go. Well, apparently it does not want me to make that point. There we go. I was about to give up on it. PowerPoint is not man for the PowerPoint. Wisdom is farsighted, but folly lives for the moment. And you see this in a series of different verses. Now, wisdom is inviting people to sit down with her for long-term reasons. Verse 6, if you choose her, you'll leave your simple ways, you'll live. You'll go down a road that is taking you toward more understanding. Verse 11, your days are going to be multiplied. You'll have years added to your life. But what about folly? She says nothing about the future. Verse 17, she only mentions temporary pleasures. It feels good and fun in the moment. Maybe there is some sort of form of joy in breaking through rules that you should be following. Maybe an adrenaline rush, maybe some self-satisfaction that you have gotten away with taking advantage of the rules. But there is no long-term joy in that path. But that is what Satan offers. Remember in Matthew 4, when Jesus has been in the wilderness fasting for more than a month, we're told in the text that he is hungry, as anybody would be had they not eaten, if they hadn't eaten for 40 days. And the first thing that Satan says is, you should use your power to take these stones over here and create loaves of bread from them, because you've got to be famished. Use your power to help you feel good now. Which, of course, goes against everything that Jesus was about. If that was his attitude, he never would have come to the earth to begin with, because his life on planet earth was a series of events in which he did what was hard, what he could have avoided with his power in order to be glorified later on with a people that he could call his own. Think about the way the people plan and make goals for earthly things in the moment. Maybe people get into dieting and weight loss, and they carefully plan out their meals, and they carefully plan out what kind of weight they want to get down to. Depending on what kind of work that you do, you might have projects and goals that you aspire to accomplish in the workplace that you are a part of. Think about what happens in a marriage ceremony. Every single detail, from what happens in the ceremony to what happens afterwards with pictures and honeymoon, everything is planned out to the detail and a minute scale. But so many people in this world have no plans at all for their eternity. Where do we fall on that scale? What plans do you have? At your stage of life, where you are when it comes to Jesus and spiritual things. Many people in this congregation are in their sunset years. Maybe you have been told, maybe you've heard, maybe you've thought about the idea that many people have said that you might retire from secular work, but you never retire from Christianity. What are your plans as the day of eternity draws closer to you? What are your plans to serve Jesus in the days that you have? If you're in your younger years, if you are like me and you are a parent with small children or children that are soon to be grown, what are your plans for helping them to reach the Lord, to ensure that their generation and the generations that come after them are like the Rechabites? Whatever your situation is, whatever your marriage status is, whatever your family situation is, what are you doing right now to make plans in a far-sighted way to attach yourself to wisdom? Or are you just living in the present moment, looking for the pleasures that you can grab right now? Why should we choose wisdom? She is one of two paths. I think the scriptures are very clear about that. We should choose wisdom because she comes from Jesus and she leads us to Jesus. And when you go to the New Testament in passages like Colossians 2, the Apostle Paul writes this: in whom, in Jesus, are hidden all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. What's interesting about the book of Colossians is Paul writes this letter to a church that he has not personally been a part of, but that he knows is struggling with a Jesus plus gospel. That teachers are seemingly coming into this group or rising up amongst the Christians there and preaching that it's nice and it's all well and good that you have the gospel of Jesus, but there are other human philosophies that you really need to get in your life to make yourself more complete. And Paul's whole argument through this letter is Jesus is enough. In fact, he is more than enough. That not just some, but all, you know, all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge are found in this Lord that we serve. In chapter 2, verse 8 of Colossians, Paul calls all the human traditions and the philosophies of the world empty and deceitful. But in this verse, he says Jesus is the true source of all the wisdom that we seek. In other words, following him is how we sit down at the table at the beginning of Proverbs 9. Following Jesus is how we partake of that rich wine in the seven-pillared house, and we eat of the slaughtered beasts on the table of Lady Wisdom and shun Lady Folly. As Paul says in Corinthians, the cross, everything that Jesus represents, everything that he came down here to do, everything that he's still doing, is considered foolishness to the world. But, as he also says, to those who are being saved, us, Christ is the wisdom of God.
and the power of God. And with all that in our minds and our hearts, let's prepare ourselves to take the Lord's Supper together, to remember this Lord who has made it his business to not just create us, but to make sure that we are not left to our own devices. To make sure that we understand who he is and what he can offer us and the feast that he's prepared. Let's take it. And I'm not just talking about this feast this morning. This is just a foretaste of the greater feast to come when we sit down at Jesus' victory table that the prophets talk about and partake of that feast with him when all of this is done. So let's appreciate all these things together.